From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a special hour of Radio Boston, exploring America's relationship with the natural world. First, we'll check in on Boston's other river, the Mystic.
We determined that if a casino got built in the Mystic River watershed, that it would do great things for the river.
Did the cleanup live up to the hype? Also today, a kayak trip through the North Shore's Great Marsh.
Okay, there's at least two snowy egrets and maybe a great egret out there. And I'm so happy that you could see these.
And film critic Ty Burr says movies are the stories we choose to tell about ourselves. We look at how films portray our relationship with the natural world.
A place that is not where we belong, that is an other, and that if we go there, it will eat us.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. In honor of the July 4th holiday weekend, we're bringing you a special hour of Radio Boston. It's a look at America's unique and complicated relationship with nature. Americans have long venerated the beauty and the purity of the land itself. Take John Muir, who founded the Sierra Club in 1892. He wrote the following as part of an impassioned plea to save America's forests. "The forests of America, however slighted by man, must have been a great delight to God, for they were the best he ever planted. The whole continent was a garden, and from the beginning, it seemed to be favored above all the other wild parks and gardens of the globe." Echoing an enduring American tradition, Muir thought that going into nature was going home, to wash ourselves clean of civilization. Of course, in many places, for that to happen, nature itself has to be cleaned up first. Entire forests have been cut down for logging and farming, rivers and streams diverted for energy and transport, and both land and water heavily polluted by our industrial practices. We see one example of that tug of war right here in our own backyard, Boston's other river, the Mystic. As late as the mid-1800s, the section of the Mystic River, where the Encore Boston Harbor Casino now stands, was both a healthy tidal marsh and a thriving home of industry. More than 500 ships that sailed around the globe were built right there on the Mystic's shores. But starting in the second half of the 19th century, it became the site of numerous chemical plants, the most recent owned by Monsanto. That resulted in heavy pollution, contaminating the land and the water. When Wynn Resorts announced in 2015 that it would be purchasing the site, part of the deal included cleaning up the river and its shores. That cleanup came with a price tag of $68 million. Decontaminating the land alone involved removing 840,000 tons of soil, enough to fill Fenway Park. In 2015, WBUR's Anthony Brooks spoke with Ekankar Singh Khalsa, then the executive director of the Mystic River Watershed Association, about the daunting task and the tantalizing prospects of cleaning up the Mystic River.
Van Morrison's great song, Into the Mystic, is about a spiritual quest. But for anyone who lives in and around Boston, where Van Morrison once lived, it's easy to imagine that he's also singing about the city's other great river, the Mystic.
Let your soul and spirit fly into the Mystic.
Which flows from the Mystic Lakes in Winchester, 7 miles south to the Tobin Bridge into Boston Harbor.
Where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home.
The Mystic is the city's other river, less well known than the Charles. But like the Charles, for centuries, it was assaulted by industry, development, and backed up storm drains, which overwhelmed it with raw sewage and all kinds of other pollutants.
I mean, the problems in the Mystic are the problems of prosperity.
This is Ekankar Singh Khalsa, or EK for short. EK is executive director of the Mystic River Watershed Association, which is working to reverse the ravages of industrialization that almost killed this river.
Great, rich communities were built, wonderful industry was created, and we weren't so good about how we managed our waste, and so we had to pay a price.
But EK is an optimist. Despite hundreds of industrial waste sites along its shores, the power plants, the oil tanks, and the long legacy of contamination, he says there's hope for the Mystic. And he says you can see it in an unlikely place, a little gritty piece of land along the river in Somerville called Draw 7 Park, right behind the Orange Line T-stop at Assembly Row.
We have a parking lot. We're right on top of the river. There are two new fishing piers. There's access to this location from the Orange Line and from Assembly Row. But as you can see, there's chain link fence. We're not quite there. But this is, in so many ways, the story of the Mystic River watershed right now. This is all the potential of the Mystic to serve 500,000 people in these 22 communities.
Which makes the Mystic one of the most densely populated urban watersheds in the state. As we head across the bridge from Somerville to Medford, EK makes the point that the Mystic is also packed with history. He points to a public boathouse on the Somerville side. It has the lyrical name,
Blessing of the Bay Boathouse.
Blessing of the Bay Boathouse.
What a great name.
Yes. Blessing of the Bay was one of the first wooden ships built in America.
EK talks a lot about the history of this river, the three centuries of industrial use from which it's trying to recover, as well as the history that helped define this country.
The Mystic saw revolutionary battles. You know, Paul Revere's ride wasn't through the Alston-Brighton tolls on the Massachusetts Turnpike. His horse rode along the banks of the Mystic to Lexington and Concord. The Mystic powered American industry, and we've got the scars to show that we did that.
Despite those scars, there's evidence that the Mystic is healing. At one point, this part of the river was choked by an aggressive invasion of water chestnuts. But thanks to an eradication program, the plants are mostly gone and the river is flowing again. There are also a series of water quality and improvement programs that have actually made long stretches of the Mystic safe for boating and recreation. Parts of it are even swimmable, but there's a lot more work to do. And you can't help comparing the Mystic River to the Charles, once upon a time dangerously contaminated, today one of the world's cleanest urban waterways.
Does that provide a kind of inspiration and model for what you folks want to do here?
Yeah, I think so, obviously. The Charles tells us what happens when you restore an urban river, is that it activates both the river and all of the space around it. It tells you also that it changes how people feel about their lives and about their neighborhood and about their community. And I think one of the challenges we have at this point in the Mystic is to change the perceptions, because water quality in the river where we are now is very, very good. Not quite as good as the Charles, but approaching it. And certainly in this section of the river, it's entirely boatable.
And what does boatable actually mean?
Well, boatable is a standard for E. coli contamination. That's the big issue here. It was the big issue in the Charles. And for boating standards, as you might imagine, the amount of E. coli allowed in water is fairly high. It's not a very rigorous standard, as you might imagine, because the exposure that you have while you're boating is fairly minimal. You're splashing water on your face, maybe you're swallowing a little water. So it's a very different standard from swimming.
Good morning, sir.
Watch your step there.
We climb aboard a powerboat and head downstream through the locks at the Amelia Earhart Dam in Somerville.
So now we're heading into salt water. This is the Mystic.
To our left on the Everett side is the site of the former Monsanto chemical plant, heavily contaminated, where cleanup has begun. This is where Wynn Resorts is spending $1.7 billion to build its resort casino.
So the cleanup, obviously good for the river. Is the building of a huge resort casino necessarily good for the future of the river?
Well, we've done our very best to make sure that it is. So we don't have a strong opinion about gambling or casinos.
Right, I get that.
Your
focus is water.
That's right. But we determined that if a casino got built in the Mystic River watershed, that it would do great things for the river. And so we have actually worked really closely with the Wynn Resorts Group to encourage some changes in the way they interface with the river. Rather than putting a hardened edge along the river, we said, look, there's no heavy traffic up here. Why not create a new salt marsh? Why not create a living shoreline? Why not restore these tidal areas and see if we can bring back life? And to their credit, they love that. And they've really embraced that idea.
I have a really basic question about what's involved with cleaning up a waterway. And this gets back to what I learned about the Charles River. And that is the big hurdle was stopping the, the sewage from going into the river. It wasn't so much actually cleaning the water or dredging it. It was just stopping the continual contamination. Is that the basic trick here?
That's a real essential first step.
Yeah.
If you don't have good water quality, it's hard to recover the general conditions. Bacterial contamination, sewage overflows, sewage leaking through stormwater pipes, all of these are problems of urban rivers. We also are concerned about sediments and what contamination remains in the sediments from all of these former industrial activities. We're unclear about that. And that creates problems in terms of recreational use because people are concerned, well, should we put a boat ramp here or not? Should I get my feet in the water or not? It's just a big open question.
So what's your timeline? I mean, what's feasible to imagine for the Mystic? I mean, you know, let's go for the gold standard. Swimmable by when?
Well, it depends what section of the watershed you're talking about. You can have a great time swimming in the upper Mystic Lakes right now. Shannon Beach is used by thousands and thousands of people every summer. I think for the saltwater section of the Mystic,
where we are right now,
Water quality is reasonably good. I don't know that I would spend a lot of time swimming here, but I definitely dive off that landing. But honestly, I would say I'd be very surprised if in the next 10 years the Mystic River is not a swimming river.
That's amazing to me. Was there a time when you would have had trouble imagining?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have a good friend who's lived in the Everett area for a long time, and he tells a great story of falling out of a rowboat with his 7-year-old friends and coming out of the river absolutely covered in oil and God knows what else. And then going home and having his mother scrub him in the bathtub for half a day to get that oil and all of these other contaminants off him. So clearly we've come a long, long way.
We turn around and head upstream back through the locks, past the Blessing of the Bay boathouse, and into a tranquil stretch of the Mystic. Great blue heron stand sentry along the lush green riverbanks, and geese swoop ahead of us. Here, for a moment, the river looks as it might have 3 centuries ago.
This beautiful stretch of river, which moves between the cities of Medford and the city of Somerville, is really quite a treasure. What's interesting about the Mystic right now is that very few people know that. So if you put your canoe or kayak in this water, you have it to yourself. And you can paddle all the way from here, about 4 miles, up to the Mystic Lakes and go for a beautiful swim.
I live in Somerville. I'm ashamed that I didn't even know about this.
I mean, this is one of the challenges. In order to get to that boathouse, you have to be brave enough to go underneath Route 93 and find this place.
Right.
The Mystic is this hidden treasure. We have barricaded it with big highways and chain link fences and prevent people from getting access because we're dotted with brownfields, all these old industrial sites that have yet to be cleaned up. But it's here. The Mystic is this splendid place, and it offers the same promise of every urban river, which is this wonderful open green space.
And magnificently we will fold into the Mystic.
That was WBUR's Anthony Brooks, speaking with former Mystic River Watershed Association Executive Director Ekankar Singh Khalsa in 2015. So how did the Encore cleanup actually go? And is the Mystic River still headed in the right direction? To answer that, we spoke with the current Executive Director of the Mystic River Watershed Association, Patrick Herron, and I started by asking him if he was happy with Wynn Resort's cleanup efforts.
Yeah, we placed a lot of hopes on the outcome of the casino. We had asked them, as you note, to clean up the Mystic in the area that they were going to do business. And they've done a remarkable job. They've created a living shoreline that benefits both the local ecosystem, but also makes dramatic change to the aesthetics of where they are. You know, along the way, they removed, you know, a tremendous amount of contaminated material, both on the land and in the sediments. And we're already seeing kind of the life come back in that area of the river. So it's a remarkable success story and a remarkable investment.
I'm guessing creating a living shoreline like that isn't easy. What, can you tell us a little bit about what that actually means to have the living shoreline?
Yeah, you know, previously this was the edge of a former industrial site and had a really hard edge, you know, steel and some broken areas. And what they were able to do is remove all of that contaminated material, regrade the landscape so that there's a proper interface between the water and the land. And you do that by hiring really outstanding engineers like GZA. You hire great people to help you with the permitting, and you hire people to go out and do the planting. And living shorelines are at the whim of nature as well. These are new plants being installed that want to be eaten by ducks and geese. And to Encore's credit, they're out there on a weekly basis replanting, picking up trash, doing what they can to make that a success. It's a remarkable effort.
So I was thinking a little bit about everything that's happened since 2015, and it's not just the Encore site. I'm also thinking Assembly Row is a pretty big development that's taken place over the last few years. Has that had any effect on the Mystic?
You know, I think it's changed all of our expectations about the river in a variety of ways. I think when you last spoke with EK, there was a question about when will the Mystic be swimmable? And certainly there are areas that are swimmable. But I think we'd like to also ask the question is when will the river be bikeable and walkable and strollable and wheelchairable? And as we see this tremendous development happening on the edge with great investment along the edges, I think it's creating higher expectations for all of us as landowners and stewards and residents to make that corridor a welcoming place, a green space for the residents in the area.
You mentioned the swimmable question. EK said that he felt he was cautiously optimistic that 10 years was about the window. We're almost halfway to that from when we talked to him in 2015. Do you feel like that's still a feasible goal?
You know, there's a lot of factors that contribute to whether something is swimmable. I'll note that on June 26th, we saw the release of the EPA water quality grade and note that this area of the river receives an A- for water quality. It is almost always meeting the standards for swimming and boating.
And this is a section that used to never do better than a D, right?
It's a section that, remember, the whole river was given a D. And there's been a change in the grading system that allows us to call out some of these areas that really have excellent water quality. And that water quality in front of Encore is due both to the great cleanup that they've done, but also great work by others to clean up Boston Harbor. This is a tidal area. So this is Boston Harbor water right in front of Encore.
Can you tell us a little bit about that grade, that A-? What does that actually mean?
What that means is it's an evaluation. The Mystic River Watershed Association collects water quality samples on a monthly basis, and we take 3 years of data and evaluate that for how frequently it meets the standards for swimming and boating based on bacteria. And it's EPA who ultimately publishes this grade. And to get an A- means that you are you have an area that is meeting those standards, both for swimming and for boating in dry weather and wet weather, almost all of the time. So there are other areas of the watershed that need improvement and don't have that grade. So we're really excited about the water quality in this area.
Yeah, so that's good news. I know that you have some other good news as well. You told me as we were setting this up that you want to make sure we take a moment to talk about the river herring. So I thought I'd give you a chance to do that. What do you want to tell us?
Well, you know, I'd say that as our perception of the river changes over time, I think we also want to remember the natural world that's present there. And it wasn't until about 2012 when the new fish ladder went in that we realized that this river also hosts one of the largest migrations of river herring in Massachusetts. I think this year we'll have close to 650,000 river herring making it up the river. And that's just a remarkable connection between the ocean and the freshwater area that is a connection to people as well as they look at these species as something they can connect to.
I think anytime we're talking about nature, the environment, we're thinking at somewhere in our minds about climate change and resiliency. How are you thinking about that as you look to the future now?
Well, it's become a big part of the work of our organization and my colleague Julie Wormser. A lot of credit goes to 14 municipalities in our watershed that are now working together in the Resilient Mystic Collaborative. This is a group of municipalities that are pooling their efforts, exchanging best practices, and seeking out projects at a regional basis that will make this watershed more resilient to flooding, more resilient to heat, and incorporating projects that are going to improve water quality and the natural environment. And this is work that the state, through their MVP program, has gotten really excited about, as well as the Barr Foundation. So we're really excited to have these partners engaged and excited to see what we're able to accomplish in the next few years.
All right. I realize this is a little bit of a curveball. The show is basically a look at America's relationship to nature and the natural world. What's that mean to you?
Well, for me, it's reconnecting in these urban spaces. I think that the Mystic River has been walled off behind overgrown trees, shrubs, and little league fields and chain link fences. And I think we're just at the phase where people are realizing the value of this river and what it can mean for their own life and being able to be out in a natural space, whether it's fishing or boating or swimming, and that this is in their neighborhood, that they don't need to get in a car to drive down to the Cape necessarily. They don't need to go to the Omni Theater at the Museum of Science, that there's something in their backyard that's quite remarkable, both from beauty and the aesthetics there, but also from the ecosystem services and the stories, the natural history stories that are right there behind them.
That from Patrick Herron, Executive Director of the Mystic River Watershed Association. Stay with us. Coming up, we'll take a kayak trip along the North Shore's Great Marsh. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. In honor of the July 4th weekend celebration, this hour we're exploring the rich and complicated history of our relationship to the natural world. Throughout American history, there's been a sense that the land itself is something to celebrate and preserve. In 1872, President Ulysses S. Grant signed a bill designating Yellowstone as the country's and the world's first national park. But since the earliest settlers landed here, that intangible, almost spiritual connection between Americans and the natural world has been in a constant tug of war with development and progress. Before the break, we looked at the Mystic River and how recent high-profile developments have actually given us an opportunity to counteract decades of neglect and exploitation and to start bringing the river back to life. So much of our world is water, and yet water remains one of our most precious natural resources. Back in 2016,
Meghna Chakrabarty took to the water alongside Deborah Kramer, author of The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey. The pair paddled their way along the North Shore's Great Marsh, the largest continuous stretch of salt marsh in New England, and they talked about the tranquil beauty all around them and the richness of life that the water makes possible.
Okay, this is good. Oh, wow. How about if we head out this way?
Let's go. And, okay? And which direction, where are we heading towards?
We're heading up Joe's Creek in Essex, is what it's called.
Okay.
And Walker Creek in Gloucester. This is such a beautiful day. It's like glass out here.
It's phenomenal. I mean, tell us whatever it is you know about Joe's Creek and just this part of the North Shore where we are.
One of the things that's so special about this place is it's part of a system called the Great Marsh, which is tidal, mudflats, estuaries, rivers, salt marshes. It's the largest expanse of uninterrupted salt marsh north of Long Island Sound.
Wow. Okay.
And it runs 25 miles from here all the way to New Hampshire. To me, it's a place of serenity and unbelievable beauty, and at the same time, it's a focal point for all of the changes that are going on right now.
You kind of get a visceral feeling for it when you're in something like a kayak, right? Because you're just hovering right on the surface
right,
of the water.
We're so close, and so I'm going to give you my binoculars. I'm going to check just to make sure this isn't a seagull.
Oh, the white bird out there.
Okay, there's at least two snowy egrets and maybe a great egret out there. And I'm so happy that you could see these. Usually I have to stay out here for 4 hours before I see what this creek has to offer.
Oh, there they go. So are we going to paddle around?
Would you like to go into Crooked Creek?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, we made it. Just right over the grass. Oh, the hundreds of cormorants right there just make it look so easy. They're just hanging out. Oh, Meghna! I'm the wrong kind of person to say, we'll go as far as you want.
Out there is Choate Island, where the Crucible was filmed.
Right.
But it's also true that Thomas Choate's wife's uncle was John Proctor, who was executed as a witch during the Salem witch trials. So that family is directly connected to the Salem witch trials. And that, they settled there, I think, in 1725. So this history is very, very old here.
I mean, let alone how long the native peoples were
and
here.
And the Agawam, right? Indians were here way before then, and there's still lots of artifacts can still be found from them.
You know, the water is so beautifully clear. I mean,
I know,
we're,
isn't it?
Right up here next to the marsh. And look, are those all clamshells that
yes.
I see down there?
Do you see some? Let's see. You see some clamshells?
Yeah.
One of Essex's great old clammers, and he showed me every single place in this marsh where they were running rum during Prohibition, because you could store it out here. You can tell it's not all that easy to get out here.
Yeah,
there are all these little inlets and tributaries and.
I love that contraband bootleg hiding in the marsh grass.
Yeah. Now, I have no idea whether this is going to work.
Maybe, but I'm not sure. Oh, I think there's a channel here.
We're going to try?
Yeah, right here.
Okay.
What are those?
Oh my goodness. Willets. Oh, Meghna, slow down.
Okay. You know, speaking of the purposes and services that this habitat provides, you know, marshes like this are also important in terms of, you know, actually protecting homes on the shores. Isn't that true from erosion?
From the surges of storms.
Yeah, and storm surge, exactly.
Marshes are wonderful at doing that, and that's why there's been a lot of money after Hurricane Sandy that's going into the Great Marsh to try to figure out how to increase its resiliency.
Yeah.
Actually, you can see from here, straight ahead is the southern end of Crane Beach.
Yes, yes, you see the sand.
You see the dunes.
In the dunes,
right. We're actually really lucky. We can see those dunes. Those dunes used to be much, much higher. Barrier beaches are the front line against storms. Long time ago, I went into the woods and I found a chimney from an old farmhouse, and the chimney was still there, and the rest of it was surrounded by sand.
Huh.
And over the years, the 30-odd years that I've been living here, this landscape has changed tremendously. So it's created sandbars and marsh that are amazing safe havens for all of these birds. But we're expecting a lot of sea level rise. And the whole idea is this marsh capable of moving landward faster than the water is rising? We don't actually know what's going to happen.
Would you say overall that the marsh is healthy right now?
Like, this is very inviting. This water is very clean right now. There's no algae. There's no scum. We swim here all the time now.
I mean, it's this beautiful, from the surface, it's this clear bottle green.
Yeah, it's truly beautiful. So in that respect, it's getting better. I worry that that so much increased boat traffic is wearing the edges away, coupled with so much sand coming in here that the channels are getting narrower and the current is running a lot faster.
You know, speaking of the current, the tide is quite strong.
Yes, it's still pulling us in. Do you want to try paddling
really
against it?
Really pulling us in. It seems to be this amazing metaphor, though, for just the current of history that's been flowing through this place for so long. I mean, it's hard not to feel the pulse of that.
You can see that the tide is flowing in and out here, has been flowing in and out here for probably at least 12,000 years. And we're the most recent arrivals here. And I don't know, when I see this out here, I really want my children to have this.
Well, do you mind if we just paddle for a bit?
Not at all.
Just sort of be?
Not at all.
And where you can should we head?
Wherever your heart desires.
Let's go head out towards the open.
Let's do that, because then we'll be able to just glide back in.
Let's go see some broad, flat water.
Okay.
That was Meghna Chakrabarty, kayaking with author Deborah Kramer through the Great Marsh in 2016. Stay with us. Coming up, we talk with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr about how film has portrayed our relationship with the natural world and what that tells us about our values. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. In honor of the July 4th holiday weekend, we're looking at the relationship between Americans and the natural world. Before the break, we took a kayak journey through the North Shore's Great Marsh. But what about our relationship to nature on a grander scale? Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr says that movies are the stories we choose to tell about ourselves. And if you look at the stories we tell about nature
it's usually not exactly a friendly relationship. In fact, he told me that the vast majority of films that focus on how we interact with nature fall into two camps. The first group tell the tale of the pioneer. We enter a harsh environment as outsiders and tame or conquer it, bend it to our will. Think The New World, Meek's Cut Off, or How the West Was Won. The other camp are films that depict humans as victims of nature. As Ty put it, they show nature as
a place that is not where we belong, that is an other, and that if we go there, it will eat us.
And if we're talking about going into nature and getting eaten, I think you can probably guess where we started our conversation. That's right, Jaws.
Now, wait a second. Dave. There are two ways to deal with this problem. Hey, you're either going to kill this animal or you're going to cut off its food supply.
Larry, we have to close the beaches.
So there you have two of the main characters basically making the argument to the mayor, we have to close the beaches. And what I was struck by was this, where there are two possible solutions. Kill the animal.
Right.
Or cut off its food supply, which means no humans can go into the water.
Right.
There's no possible way that we could coexist.
And, you know, amusingly enough, or unamusingly enough, that's kind of the argument we're having now that the sharks have come back because the seals have come back and there was a death last summer and it's a real issue. I will say that I think in the 40 years since that movie came out, we are having a different discussion. There is more of an understanding that when we go swimming there, we're in their territory. So in a weird way, I think the discussion is more about what do we have to do to allow them to be in their habitat, you know, without damaging us.
Yeah, you mentioned obviously that there have been increased shark sightings. There was the death tragically last year.
Yes.
That was the first one in, I believe, over 80 years.
Yes.
In the Massachusetts area. And this is a real issue right now. There were stores that had to pull shark merchandise mm-hmm. off the shelves. I'm wondering, Jaws is such a celebrated film. Is our attitude towards that movie going to change as we continue to see sharks as a real-world threat as opposed to kind of a campy summer movie kind of
No, situation? Because it's one of the great boo movies of all time, and it is brilliantly constructed. And, of course, you know, the bad guy in it is a mechanical shark. It's not actually a real shark, and the story's about trying to get it to behave for the camera or Legion. And no, it's a great movie, and it's a great, you know, it's a great campfire tale, and it works. And it's so, you know, it's a classic for a reason. I think one piece of the puzzle just that we're not talking about here is one of the reasons the sharks are back is the seals are back. And part of the conversation is about the food chain and how do we deal with that? Hey, we're part of the food chain too.
Right.
Do we cull the seals? Do we let them be? All of that. And I do think there is a larger conversation and a larger understanding, the larger forces at work.
Yeah, and there are some communities that are really going to be affected as
yes.
these attitudes change, that,
mm-hmm.
that their entire kind of tourism industry could potentially be at risk depending on how much of a threat this
right.
ends up being.
Right.
So interesting that we start with Jaws because there was another movie on the list that you did send me that doesn't necessarily, it's not a parallel with Jaws, but I was struck by kind of the dichotomy here, and that's Grizzly Man.
Yes.
For those who are not aware, it's a documentary by Werner Herzog that features Timothy Treadwell, who goes out and spends time living with the bears for years and years.
Well, I'm here with one of my favorite bears. It's Mr. Chocolate. Hey, Mr. Chocolate. He is the star of many people across the country, children, people, adults, and we're here in a grizzly sanctuary, but I'm wrapping up my work here in a grizzly sanctuary. Why is that? Because I'm on my way to the grizzly maze, where bears do not have human protection, but are under human threat.
So,
oh, man.
yeah. It's different than Jaws because obviously the humans are there to go into the ocean and kill this shark.
Right.
Here's an individual who goes into the bear's habitat with a respect for the way they live, and yet he still ends up dying in a bear attack at the end of the film.
Well, I would argue very much with him going in there with respect. If anything, I think he illustrates civilized human beings' profound alienation from the natural world because he totally anthropomorphizes them. He calls, you know, Mr. Chocolate. He treats them like cuddly bears. He's an idiot. You know, it's a matter of time before he gets his head chewed off, which is exactly what happens. And, you know, the movie is made by Herzog from the documentary footage that this guy shot. So it's repurposed to give a portrait of somebody who I think is really at odds with nature, really doesn't understand, A, his place in the food chain, and B, how you actually deal with nature and animals that are not to be anthropomorphized, not to be cutified, that are not to be understood but to be lived next to somehow.
Yeah. So there were two other films that jumped out from your list that I felt had a common thread, and that was 127 Hours and Wild.
Yeah.
So these are both fairly recent films that 127 Hours depicts a hiker who goes out and his arm is stuck under a boulder, has to amputate his own arm. Wild, the Reese Witherspoon vehicle where a solo woman goes and hikes a trail by herself out in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Two films that really feature humans going into nature,
right,
arguably unprepared for the situations they're going into.
Correct.
And yet are celebrated as the heroes of the story, really. And I was just kind of intrigued. I should say they're both based on true stories.
Right.
How do you see those films and kind of the commonalities between them?
I see them slightly differently. I think the character played by James Franco in 127 Hours is a little closer to Timothy Treadwell. He is, I think, portrayed as naive, going into the desert by himself, not leaving, you know, letting anybody know where he is. And nature gets him. You know, once again, we're the victim of,
right,
of unthinking nature. Rock pins his arm and he ends up having to cut off his arm. I think Wild is a different kind of archetypal story that we like to tell ourselves, which is about going back to nature. You know, we're too civilized. I mean, from Thoreau on, from the Pilgrims on, we go back to nature to somehow purify ourselves. As a total aside, my one of my daughters thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail a couple of years ago. Anytime we were talking to people about it, anytime she was talking to people about it, they could only reference it, this sort of large thing that it's hard to sort of conceptualize, by saying, did you see Wild? Did you read A Walk in the Woods? And those two properties came up every single time. Every single time it came up in conversation, to the point where, you know, my daughter just was sick of it. And it was all well meant, but it just made me realize how we use these narratives to come to grips with a nature that we really don't understand, and that is not to be easily understood.
Yeah, that's really powerful, that the only way people have to connect to that is through film, and I think,
right,
that kind of speaks to the pervasiveness of movies in our society. I'm curious how you're thinking. We talked about this relationship, this adversarial relationship, mm-hmm, of human versus nature, and how prevalent it is through film. It feels like our cultural attitude towards nature and towards the natural world has shifted over the last,
sure,
couple of decades, and then maybe exponentially over the last few years. Why do you think film hasn't necessarily mirrored that shift, or do you think it has?
I think, you know, the media, the stories we tell ourselves are always slow to catch up. And I do think the DNA of this country is about conquering the wilderness, is about taming the frontier. It's about coming to this wild, unpeopled country, which was, of course, peopled by people who were there before we got here, and taming it and making it safe for civilization. And you look at all the Westerns and all the classic Hollywood films, and that's what they're about, how the West was won. And then, you know, then we ran out of frontier, and the stories start to change. And I think because we're becoming increasingly aware, I mean, it starts in the 60s when you look at movies like Little Big Man, and just generally the new Hollywood had a counterculture view of what man has and America has done to its natural wilderness. And that sort of percolates through movies like Dances with Wolves,
Jeremiah Johnson,
The Revenant even.
Right.
But I also think that now that we're in a stage where we realize there quite likely will be major die-offs of species, that we will be having probably cataclysmic effects on how we live and on nature, which are caused by us, I think you're starting to see that leak into the stories we tell. One film we were talking about was Meek's Cut Off.
That's what you think, that we're lost?
I'd say that seems about the right word for it.
We're not lost, we're just finding our way.
I don't blame him for not knowing. I blame him for saying he did.
So this is a film that is also based on real events, set in 1845. There was a real Meek who led an expedition of about 200 wagons,
right,
through the wilderness, and two dozen people ended up dying over this journey.
Right.
The film kind of simplifies that. There's a smaller cast of characters.
Yes, three couples.
Right.
But it's still a pioneer wagon train, and the leader is still kind of a eccentric, not to be trusted person, but he's the only person who claims he knows the way. And over the course of the film, the various couples, to one degree or another, realize they can't trust him, but he's the only person that knows the way. And they have taken a Native American hostage. And he knows the way. He knows the land. He knows the land. So do they trust this person or do they trust that person? But it illustrates this. How do we come to grips with this being strangers in a strange land, in this hostile land that actually, if you learn to live with it, you can find your way. If you approach it as something to be fought, you will lose your way. And there aren't many movies that do that. So I think that's an interesting film.
Yeah. Two things I want to follow up there on. One, you mentioned earlier Westerns, and this is kind of a way for us to get into the Western genre a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That is obviously a truly American genre. And I think one where you can see a little bit of a celebration of the natural world. It is harsh, definitely, but at the same time, there are these incredible landscapes, and the beauty of it is pretty apparent.
Yep.
Absolutely, yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the Western genre? I mean, that's a genre that started here and really has spread all over the world.
Right. It really is about civilized man coming into this gorgeous, untamed playground and taming it and learning to live in it. The more mature, complex Westerns really do address some of the complexities. And you know, a movie like The Searchers, in which John Wayne does not play a sympathetic character at all.
Right.
And whereas, you know, legions of cowboy serials and shoot 'em ups and, as you know, B Westerns just tell that story much more simply and romantically. And, you know, these are the fables and lies on which we have built our national myth. This isn't quite a Western, or you could argue actually it's the first Western, and it's the Terrence Malick movie The New World, which is really about the landing of the first British people in this country, and it's the Pocahontas story. One of the themes of it is how wild and beautiful and unknown this country is to these people who are coming to it for the first time.
Yeah. The other thing that jumped out to me from Meek's Cutoff and from this genre, The folks who are depicted, the characters who are depicted as connected to the land seem to be Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That's the case, as you said, in Meek's Cutoff. I was thinking also of Last of the Mohicans.
Right.
There is this idea that the Native people were connected to the land. What does that say to you, that those are the characters that really share that connection with the natural world?
Well, you know, it plugs into the sort of the archetype of the noble savage, which is one way to soothe our guilt over what we've done to these people.
Right. I mean, you can't talk about this without talking about some of the atrocities that have been committed swaths of people.
Right. The more honest movies address that. And there is a history of – there's a small genre of Native American-made Native American movies. Powwow Highway is an indie film I'm thinking of from the 80s that are – the people themselves telling the stories of that they've lived. Those are the ones we should be paying attention to. Last of the Mohicans, which I think is a brilliant movie, but is also absolutely, the original novel is a linchpin in that archetype. And it's something that I think we still really, as a culture, haven't addressed enough and sort of told the right way. But I do think that there is a truth at the bottom of it that Europeans came to this country and found people that had been living there for millennia and who had come to terms with how to live there, and in a way that was at harmony with the harshness and lushness of the habitat. They were truly at one with the world in which they lived. And as colonizers, we weren't. You know, that's kind of the history of our country to a certain degree. That's one of the things I think The New World gets right. I think it's one of the things Little Big Man gets right. I don't think enough movies get that right.
Yeah. There's also the notion there that Europeans did come to this country and tamed the natural world, exploited the natural
Correct.
World in many ways, and really resulted in a cost that we're still paying and still trying to figure out how to mitigate.
I don't think we've paid the full price yet, you know?
Yeah. How would you like to see that addressed in films kind of as we look forward?
It's a big question. It really, because personally I believe that we are facing a crisis and we as a people and we as a government and we as governments have to deal with it more than movies and TV do. But
you talked about the pervasive nature of film and kind of how it's for so many people, it's how they connect to real world things.
And it's how we tell the stories about ourselves.
Right.
I would like to see more specific nitty-gritty news you can use about how to integrate with the world as opposed to live apart from it.
Well, because there is this thing within us that feels if I can get out into the wilderness,
yes,
that it does kind of cleanse me, that there is this notion of that's the pure form. I mean, that's life.
That's why my daughter went, you know, hiking on the Appalachian Trail. And all the people who do that, that's one of the reasons they do that. They want to be somehow purified. We feel dirty living in the world we live in. How do we do it in a way that is not naive, that doesn't make us Timothy Treadwells? You know, how do we do it in a way that repairs things instead of stomping around and banging our heads against the wall and getting eaten by bears and dying in abandoned school buses? That's the challenge for us. And that's the challenge of the stories we have to tell. I would love to see some stories that dramatize that successfully, not as moral lessons, but as compelling dramas. I think more of those stories are useful in helping us reconnect with this idea of as nature as something that we are part of and live in and not apart from and need to beat into submission.
That was Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. From all of us here at the show, have a wonderful 4th of July holiday weekend. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.